This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to More Than a Muse. I'm Stani.
And I'm Sadie, and thank you for being here to learn more about women and the arts and talk with us, or I guess listen to us talk and discuss it all. I'm excited to be here today.
Me too. I'm actually really excited about this episode too.
Me too. This week is one of our topic episodes. I don't think we've ever formally described the format, but every other week we do an artist. And then the weeks we're not doing an artist, we will cover just a basic topic that touches on the areas of women and the arts and relates to it in some ways. So that's our pattern,
like,
I guess.
A little bit of back end on that. We usually try to pick one more historical topic and then one more pop culture relevant topic.
True.
And then we have Sadie's artist of the month and then my artist of the month. And if there is a fifth Monday, which sometimes happens, then we just kind of do whatever we want.
Yes, and that's fun.
It is fun. I like having five in a month. It's always a little wild card.
So I guess whatever you like the most, I don't know. We got something if you're just here to learn about artists or if you'd rather the discussions. But hey, listen to them all, I hope.
Yeah, test them all out. I think they're fun. The reason why we did it is, I don't know, history is just... it's just pop culture from the past. You know what I mean?
Very true. Yes.
And I think about that all the time, especially with artists we find where it's reading about different gossip stuff and everything that happened. And it's just oh, Dumas would have had a field day with this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
1,000%. This would have been page six headlines everywhere. And I think it's fun to see the parallels between what was happening then, and what's happening now, and how it's not that different. And that's comforting sometimes. And other times it's completely devastating.
Absolutely. Well, I think even just a couple weeks ago, we covered the opera singer Maria Callas and the amount of things that were just direct mirrors to what we're seeing nowadays. Yeah, it's crazy. And I love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
History is just pop culture, except 100 years ago or however many years ago.
And it's fun to draw those parallels. And I think that this is one of those episodes where we definitely are.
Yeah.
Talking a lot about something that's existed for a really long time and how it continues to exist and kind of how it's been called out recently. And also the fact that this has been a huge TikTok trend over the past couple of months.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty sure everyone's at least heard of these ideas.
Terms, even if male gaze versus female gaze. Absolutely. Yeah. I was going to say this obviously has existed forever and we've talked about it and touched on it in previous episodes. But I feel the actual terminology, at least more recently, has been more popularized to this male female gaze, almost to the point that people are getting tired of people talking about it on TikTok and things like that. But hey, it's important to discuss and discuss when it's legitimate and it's something that we should, be aware of. And it's interesting.
Yeah,
I think it's just fun to talk about.
I think it's incredibly interesting. It actually, there's so much more to it than we'll even cover in this, which I feel like we're always saying. Because all of these topics people have written books and essays on, I feel like you could teach an entire college class.
On the male versus female gaze. Yeah.
Yeah, just because it's fascinating. So it's more of just a little taste. But it definitely makes me want to look at things differently or read some of these books that we'll mention.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just to briefly start, I'll talk later about how media kind of shows the male versus female gaze. But I think a more recent personal example of this is, have you seen the TV show or heard of it? It's called Reacher on Amazon Prime. So it's based on a book series called Jack Reacher, where it's basically this former military policeman who's retired and just travels. He's kind of a nomad, no one can hold him down type of person, you know what I mean? He goes from city to city solving crimes and things like that. Anyways, we were watching it, and my husband and I, and like the first episode, I was just giggling because the character just like kept making just really witty jokes, and it just seemed like every person was just like, whoa, he's so big and strong. And I was like, okay, like there's no way that like people actually would be like that, like he would draw that much attention for being that tall. And Jordan was like, no, he really is like that big of a guy in real life, like you would totally do that, because it takes place in a really really small city in Georgia.
Oh,
so
yeah,
he was like, if that happened. And I was like, I'm just not buying it. But basically by the end of it, I was like, oh, this is for men, like this is the male fantasy.
Yeah,
of how they want the world to see them. And so that was my male gaze TV show. And then at the same time, I was watching Bridgerton for the first time, where I think is a great example of a man for the female gaze, or for the female audience.
Yeah, I would argue most Regency films are.
Very, very true. And so when I was watching like both of those shows at the same time, I was just like laughing at the difference between the way that their male characters were presented. And It's just funny. It's not necessarily good or bad, because I was like, you know what? This is a rom-com for men, and I'm just watching a rom-com for women. And sometimes people have different audiences, and obviously they treat their characters differently if they're catering it to different audiences. But it was just a very funny, like, tangible example. And I knew you were doing this episode, and I was like, that's hilarious.
No, I love that. I also feel like it kind of, we owe a disclaimer at the beginning that, of course, this is coming from, like, a very heteronormative viewpoint.
True.
Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that, like, there's not women who find the more, like, manly men more attractive, or men who feel that way, you know, like.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, there's so many different spectrums. It's more of just, like, patterns of how people have viewed male viewers and male filmmakers versus female viewers and female filmmakers over time.
Totally.
There's some major differences.
There is some major differences. It's crazy.
It's really crazy.
Well, do you want to start off and talk about the origins of all this?
Yes. So first we'll talk about the male gaze. It was a term coined by a feminist film theorist, which I don't find surprising at all, actually.
No.
Named Laura Mulvey, and she actually wrote a book in 1975.
Wow.
So that's the earliest of that exact term being used. Obviously, the idea of it has existed for a lot longer. Mm-hmm. But she had a book called Visual Pleasure and Narrative Cinema, which sounds extremely interesting. I'm sure a lot of film majors are probably required to read it.
Totally.
And it was just the idea that through media and culture and art, that women are objectified and seen primarily for their physical appearance. They're a prop.
Yep. A means to an end.
Yes, exactly. And it becomes so obvious the minute you start noticing it, like how often women are used this way. She stated that men have historically had power over what they wanted to see or not see in visual art because it was made predominantly by them. So because they get to pick what's shown and what's not shown, it leads to an artistic tradition where men get pleasure from looking at females who take on passive roles in the narrative.
Interesting. Yes.
Yeah. It kind of like, it made me think of a lot of things. The fact that like, if men are writing the story, I feel like you generally choose a character who's your gender.
Totally.
If you're writing, or even if you're reading, I find myself drawn more to books where
Because it's almost like you don't have to work so hard to relate to the character.
Yes. Like you understand how their brain works. And that makes sense with writing, too. Like, you'd want to write from a perspective. And, of course, I've read, like, romance novels where they flip back and forth between the male point of view and the female point of view. But, of course, the female is the main character. That's never the question.
Yeah.
So, if men are all the ones making art, if you think about it, men were the commissioned artists. Men were the only ones allowed to write for money, the only ones allowed to participate in many of these activities. It makes sense that all of the narratives surrounded the main role of a man.
I mean, and that's not even a bad thing, because as artists, you write what you know.
Yeah.
You portray what you know. So that's not in itself a bad thing.
Mm-mm.
But if they're the only ones making the art, then obviously that will affect society. That, wow, the implications of that are crazy to think about.
They're insane. Because that's the problem. She's not even saying that it's like bad to have like male artists or like creating roles for men. The problem is just that it created the tradition that allowed men to do whatever they wanted with the women side characters in everything.
And it's almost like men were the only one making the art or making, you know, the movies in majority. But yet we were seeing, like, we were viewing that as like what it should be.
Yes.
When in reality, it's just from one, it's just from their perspective.
Yep. Exactly. Interesting. So that's the problem. It's not necessarily the perspective existing. It's the fact that it was the only one.
Only one. And then now that's being seen as what should be and what is correct and good and right.
Yes. Which is the major problem. She also said that it's important to note that men can be objectified just like a woman would be, but it's just much more likely for women to be objectified because there are fewer female directors making films than there are men. So she wasn't saying that like women are exempt from it. Like, women objectify men.
Yeah. It happens. All the time.
Yeah. But it just doesn't happen as often because the amount available for that is so much different. She also talks about how the male gaze can like really teach young women that they need to look desirable in order to get attention from boys.
Totally.
Because that's what movies do. The most beautiful, attractive woman in the world gets all of the attention from the men. And it also turns around and teaches young boys that it's okay to view women as sex objects because that's what the camera lens does. And we'll talk about a lot of examples of that, but like you watch some of these scenes back and it's just like, oh my gosh, get your camera off of her chest.
Yeah.
She has a face. She also talks about how like there's so many different ways that the male gaze, like so many different filters it has to go through that makes it even worse. So not only is it the men behind the camera that are controlling how the camera pans, how it views, what it focuses on, what's in frame, how the frame is viewed. It's also the men in the scene, how they're reacting to the woman in the scenario, what's happening around her, what they're doing, how they respond to her, how they talk about her. Then it goes to the men watching the film, what they're focusing on, what they're saying about the character, how they feel about it. And then I even felt the need to add a fourth, men creating the character.
Yeah.
Men writing the scripts, deciding what she's going to wear, what she looks like, how she acts, what she says. Those are all different things that create the male gaze and make it even harder to burst out of. Because it's not just the camera. It's everything else.
It's everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you seen people like online talking about the writer of Euphoria? And he just created a new show called The Idol. And pretty much just talking about the fact that it's like at a certain point, like this is gross. Mm-hmm. Like if you want to make art and you want to write scripts that just have so much of women being degraded and manipulated and like that's weird.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, we need to stop supporting that because it's almost like we're giving them permission in the name of like art's sakes or being provocative or things like that. You know, it's just, yeah, it's just gross. And I've seen a lot of people talking about it. I've seen the first season of Euphoria. And I didn't end up watching the second season because it was just kind of sad. I don't know. Yeah. And I haven't watched The Idol. I won't. But yeah, it's really interesting people kind of finally calling that out of like, if you're writing TV shows about high schoolers having like really graphic sex and like being degraded and like you want to depict that all the time, it's like, I don't know. Like maybe something's wrong. And like, why are we so like fine with that?
Well, I've heard even like other co-stars have complained about how he treated Sydney Sweeney.
Yeah.
Like for every single shot, he was like, take off your shirt, or it would be better if you didn't have your shirt on, or, oh, I think this needs to be nude. And she's like the only one.
Yeah, the only one. Like she's naked a lot in that show.
Yeah. And it's just like, oh, that's a problem. You know, then it's not just the content that's being filmed, it's the way that you're shooting the content.
Exactly.
And that's kind of the main problem with the male gaze. It strips women of their representation. It doesn't allow them to tell their own stories. It doesn't allow them to present their bodies in a way that they want to. It's presented in the most idealized, glossy version that the men want. It also, she said, it can make women prisoners of men's expectations. And I think that that's what contributes to a lot of the misogyny we have in our world is like if constant depictions of women are being controlled by men, then soon enough, your own depiction of yourself is going to match that
because that's what you think you should be.
Yeah. And they also compare it to like racial theory a lot because they say like The depiction of women by men also reinforces the otherness associated with females. The woman becomes the other that's defined only against a man, which is a lot of the times how other races are treated within stories and media as well. Like they're only...
It's the other. It's the non-typical.
They're an accessory to the main character's story.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, being a main character is kind of toxic.
Yeah, that's true.
Because everyone else only exists to serve your narrative. You.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why there's no such thing as main character in real life.
True.
As much as people would love to argue about that.
Listen, I sure would love to be the main character in my own life, but that's toxic and bad. So other people...
Too much pressure.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
So agreed. Like, that's why real life isn't a movie. So moving into a little bit of the male gaze in art. It's everywhere, just so you know.
Yeah, I didn't realize it so much. But then when I was reading over your notes about it in art, I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's horrifying.
It's everywhere. Everywhere so much that in the 1800s, a French art critic and historian named John Ruskin wrote about how paintings of nude women should be framed that they are looking out at you.
Ooh.
Yeah, which of course just cements the idea that women who are naked should be depicted solely for the pleasure of the viewer.
Yeah, gross.
Why does she have to look at you? Why does that have anything to do with you? And it made me remember, I love this quote. I think I saw it on like Pinterest or something, but when I was doing this whole thing, I kept thinking about it. This is an art critic named John Berger. He actually wrote it in his book called Ways of Seeing, which is another thing that sounds really cool. But he wrote, "You painted a naked woman because you enjoyed looking at her. You put a mirror in her hand and you called the painting vanity, thus morally condemning the woman whose nakedness you had depicted for your own pleasure."
Wow.
Yep.
That is a great quote.
I know. I love it. And it reminds me of a lot of people have been taking like older portraits and putting like phones in women's mm-hmm. hands, like a selfie. And they laugh about it. And they're like, oh, it's funny. Like, that's what it makes it look like. And it's like, oh, you don't understand. A man painted this of a woman.
True.
Don't condemn her for doing that. It has nothing to do with her. So
very true.
That's important to remember. And yeah, that's kind of the main idea of the male gaze in art. Naked women are everywhere in art. And that's one question that you might have is like, why are there so many nudes everywhere? Mm-hmm. And a large part of that is the male gaze. It's not a strictly sexual enjoyment factor.
That's what I was going to say is it's like, on the other hand of that though, it's like the people who are like naked people in art, that's pornography. And it's like, no, it's not.
No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what they kind of described it as is that it's more of the way that they're painting them, not necessarily why they are either. Because a lot of the times artists are using it to study the human body.
True.
Mm-hmm. And that's not like a sexualized content. But the way that they're painting these women were so idealized and so like focused on the viewer themselves that that's mm-hmm. what makes it toxic.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the reason why it's important to art history is because it helps us understand like the culture and mindset of the artist and why that shows up in artwork. And one thing I liked, I found this article, I'll have to link it. I don't remember who wrote it. But she talked about how like it's not so much that they painted naked women, it's the way that they painted naked women, how all of them were depicted in this super idealized versions that aren't realistic for how like women actually are. And that's where the problem comes from, because it was making women look, how would I explain it? Like photoshopping a supermodel on a magazine cover.
Yeah, I was like, it's just fake. It's not real. Yeah. It's not an ideal that you can even hope to achieve to because no. It's just not real.
Completely unattainable.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it with men too. It's just, it shows up a lot in painting with women.
Yeah.
So here's some examples. One of them is Sandro Botticelli's Birth of Venus. I think one thing that shows this is Venus, who's the goddess of the sea, is the most exposed out of anyone in the painting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She's also looking directly at the viewer. And Venus is the nude female figure of Aphrodite. So it's like the perfection of goddess of love. She doesn't have to worry about modesty or imperfection. She is love personified.
True. Like,
mm-hmm. She has long golden hair that perfectly covers the parts of her that she doesn't want to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
She's literally like not even a natural skin tone color. literally looks like she's carved out of marble. So that's kind of a thing. Like, it's the depiction of female bodies in a way that is just a personification of an ideal. Like, that's not realistic. And I would argue that, sadly, this is probably a more realistic representation of the female body than in more current
forms. I was just going to say, though, like, it's almost like you look at the pictures of Greek, more old paintings, I guess, and that does seem more attainable than what we are seeing now.
And that just shows how far it's gone. Yeah. And I think that's part of the problem with the male gaze, is because it's existed for so long, it's easier to just push it an inch further every time.
Totally.
Another one is John Augusta Dominique Ingres. I'm going to say all of that wrong. But Grande Odalisque. Is that how you say it?
Odalisque, maybe?
Odalisque. I don't know. It's a really famous nude painting of a woman. It's a
very pretty painting.
It is. It's pretty. And from a glance, you immediately be like, oh, how tasteful. Because her back is like facing the camera. But what they brought up is that it's a very intimate scene that's like, feels a little like you're invading.
Yes.
And she has really elongated proportions.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, that is a long back.
Yep. I think someone even mentioned, like, scientifically it doesn't work because she'd have to have, like, two extra vertebrae.
True. Like, this isn't me body shaming people with long backs. That is just not a way
it's scientifically human not bodies possible.
Are a thing.
Yeah. And so that's kind of the problem, too. It's an idealized version of life. Like, obviously it looks gorgeous, but, like, no woman could ever pose and look like that unless you elongate your back surgically order to look that way. And that kind of creates more of that problem. So, like I said, it's not the fact that she's nude or, like, her position necessarily. It's the fact that they continue to idealize these women in a way that isn't realistic.
Yeah, it just shows that this has been going on for a very, very long time.
Yes. Okay, this one's my favorite one. Because it's so weird. And I remember even when it came up in art history class being like, what the heck?
Oh, this is interesting. Yes.
Yeah. It's Edward Manet's Dejeuner Sur. I'm sorry, guys. I'm probably saying so many of these wrong. I will post them. I did take the art history classes. We only had to know how to write them. Yep, I didn't have to, like, ever say them out loud. So I can get the artist names right most of the time if they're, like, pretty familiar. But, like, the painting names, I'm sorry.
They're just in different languages. That's all. Yeah,
it's French. I don't know what to tell you. I didn't learn French. I'm very American. It's an impressionist painting. Arguably beautiful. It's a picnic.
It's an interesting setting, though.
The men are fully clothed, and both of the women are completely nude.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, especially because, like, they're outside. Like, it's not like they're in a bedroom. Like,
yep.
Hmm.
And these aren't men in, like, t-shirts and shorts. These are men in three-piece suits.
Yes. And hats.
Yes. And the women are completely nude. It's weird.
Yeah.
It's so weird. It doesn't make any sense. And the
this is just nude, a male fantasy, I guess, yes, right here. Yes.
Both the men are, like, talking to each other, and then the female is looking out at the viewer.
Oh, true.
Yeah, which is another notable thing. One thing I thought was interesting in the article, she said, meanwhile, this painting may have made any woman looking at it uncomfortable imagining herself in that situation.
Valid. Yeah, absolutely.
Public park, you're sitting there nude with two men who are fully clothed in three-piece suits, completely ignoring the fact that you're even there.
Yeah, weird. I would truly be, pretty uncomfortable with that. I admit it.
Yes. And so they said that this one is, like, a perfect example of the male gaze, because also the women are nude, but they're also, like, not a part of the
they're their accessories.
Yeah, they're just, like, a prop. They're there. Totally. Their presence not even being considered. The men in the painting aren't even looking at them.
No, not at all. They're looking at each other. They're very engaged with one another.
Yes. So it's just, like, a really good example, or, like, a good example of the male gaze, even though it's kind of really uncomfortable to look at.
Very much so. Yes.
Yeah. So that's a good one to look up if you immediately want to think about it. Another one she brought up that was really interesting that I included just because I think it's a different idea of it. There's this pop art piece called Crying Girl by Roy Lichtenstein, or Lichtenstein. And it's just this woman crying. It's kind of, like, zoomed up on her nails, wiping away a tear in her lips. And the woman's not nude, but, like, her emotions are, like, hyper-emphasized, which kind of buys into the ideal of like every woman is emotional kind
crazy.
Of thing.
Crazy, yeah.
And she said that what's notable about this is that because it was created in 1964, it's when a lot of these like narratives about how women are being depicted in art, how things are being seen, were coming to the forefront. So they're like, he might have done it in a way to acknowledge the male gaze in some...
Like, we don't know what the intentions are, and maybe it wasn't malicious.
Yeah.
But it's, I think at the very least, is just an example of how it could sometimes be depicted if it's not, like, as nudes.
Yes. It doesn't always have to be a nude. It can be just men kind of perpetuating stereotypes of women. Or even the fact that, like, she's sobbing, but her makeup is still perfect and her nails.
Yeah, she still looks very beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just kind of one of those things that adds into it. And obviously there's millions more. And what's hard about the male gaze is because it's like a subconscious result of culture and society. A lot of the times people may not even realize they're buying into it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes it so toxic is because it's not even necessarily the works of art or the artists that painted them's fault. It's just the fact that that's how society's been for so long that it's almost unnoticeable. And isn't that worse?
Oh, 1,000%. Yeah, like I said, like at the beginning, like the implications of the fact that it's all been just men creating the narratives and we've just accepted that as like at its face value of like, oh, yeah, then this is what it is and this is what it should be.
Exactly. So it's just kind of one of those things to keep in mind. She also brought up that she had a close friend who was a guy that asked her several times why he's drawn to art that features nude women. And she was kind of like, look, you've probably been conditioned as a man to, like, appreciate that and to look at that. Mm-hmm. And it's been perpetuated for so long that, like, that's what looks
That's what you're drawn to. That's what you like. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, like, it's not even necessarily your fault. It's just, like, recognizing that you can look at the world differently once you know why you're looking at the world that way. And then hopefully be able to move away from how society is viewing things and start to look at stuff your own way.
Yeah, or at least just like know where preferences come from and just and I think at the very least then it just shows that's like my preferences are because of like there's other factors. It's not always innate.
Yes.
You just get to be aware of it.
One thing I also wanted to mention, we did a Gorilla Girls episode, like one of our first years. But they had a huge famous like push where they had a huge poster that said, do women have to be naked to get into the Met Museum?
Yeah,
that was in 1989. And they were talking about how there were more nudes of women in the Met than there were women artists. Women
artists.
Oh. Yeah. And so kind of like, oh, if we're naked, will you let us be in the Met?
It's not good.
No, it's really not. And they've done a lot of work on that. They also have a exhibition, I think, pretty recently called The Male Grays.
Nice.
Where they talk a lot about this issue and why it continues to be a problem. They also brought up another article I found, brought up Judy Chicago and her dinner party, which we've talked about previously. You pretty much can't study art history or feminist art in any capacity and not come across this piece of art.
We should do an episode that deep dives on it because we've just touched on it so many times.
We have. It's a really big, important part of art. But I encourage everyone to look it up if you haven't seen it. It was a triangular table with 39 seats dedicated to an important woman from history. Mm-hmm. And each porcelain plate at the setting had like motifs that she was inspired by like vulvas for.
Mm-hmm.
Like vaginal iconography. So the pretty way of saying it.
Yes.
And a lot of people were really upset by that because they were like, how pornographic, how vulgar, you know, to show the female body that way. Never mind that we have the David. Whatever. So it's kind of a lot of people thought it was contradictory to turn around and get mad at the male gaze and then to push a feminist agenda where they use vaginal or like vulva iconography in their art as like a feminist example when like isn't that kind of what you're not doing and yet you're creating art centered around it. But I kind of love that what they brought up is that the first generation of feminist artists were actually owning the right to rewrite the way in which their bodies have been represented. And one was oppressing, one's liberating. So it's kind of like taking back the narrative yourself and allowing you to show your body how you want to rather than how the men want to. And I think that's an important thing I'm noticing, is that, like, sometimes taking the male gaze back doesn't mean not having women in, like, maybe more revealing situations or, like, sexual scenes in film. It's more allowing the woman to be a more active part of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Rather than just a prop in the
story. In the side piece of it all. Yeah.
Anyway, it's everywhere in our history. There's a lot of female artists that have been creating more, like, female gaze-driven nudes of women. One I'll bring up, I want to do an episode on her eventually, but Suzanne Valadon, I highly recommend. If you want to look up just, like, completely different depictions of female figure in art, amazing. And she was pretty much ignored throughout her whole lifetime, like, ignored for a century. And
that's weird. That never happened.
But she just has, kidding. Like, some really cool, unique depictions of, like, the female body in art and paintings. So
cool. Yay. Well, I'm excited for that future episode. We're gonna take a quick break just to spotlight one of our new favorite women artists.
Okay, so this comes with a story.
I'm ready.
I just saw this TikTok where a lady was on the phone with her landlord getting yelled at for putting chalk on the driveway.
I've seen that. Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Insane. And so it was like, oh, what did she do? And then it turns out she was just, like, doing little chalk art of little Pokemon on her driveway of her rental unit. And her landlord compared it to graffiti.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And said that she was, like, defacing property, even though, like, you can literally wash it off. So then the city gave her permission to go and do it on the sidewalk. And her landlord got mad about that and said she was going to take it to city council because she didn't think it should be allowed. And she kept saying, like, I know some people view it as art, but, like, I just think it's really disrespectful for you to do that to my property. And, like, I pay taxes, and so that you shouldn't be allowed to do it on the sidewalk either. And then she was like, yeah, but I pay you rent. And also, it's not in the lease.
It is chalk art. Like,
it's chalk.
If she was, like, you know, writing something really offensive, like, objectively, you know, like, even, like, political offensive. I mean, I guess, unfortunately, some people could take political and run with it. But you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. If it was actually a bad thing, she was drawing sexually lewd images. That's one thing.
Then it would be different. Mm-hmm. But she's drawing, like, little cartoon characters. Anyway, she's actually really good at this. Like, there's
she
no
is.
Way
uh-huh.
yeah, that I could do any of this. She uses, like, water and paint brushes to, like, give it a smooth texture. And what I thought was really cool is the town actually got involved because obviously everyone thought it was ridiculous. So they put her in charge of a new event called Chalk the Town.
That's so nice.
And they're having her chalk the town along with a bunch of other people. It's just downtown in, I think, the city of Hutchinson in Kansas. So if you live there for the July 4th week, they're going to do a bunch of chalk art all over town.
That's
and
adorable.
Have, like, prizes and food booths and everything else. So the town's backing her up. Thank heavens.
I want to know, like, who's on this old lady's side? Like,
I don't
what?
Think anyone. It's just her.
And I'm sure she's doubling chalk. Down.
And she was even like, I don't see that at any other property. And it's like, have you never walked by a house in the summer?
Yeah.
There's also always sidewalk chalk. Kids are out there playing hopscotch and stuff. Like, what on earth?
And you want to know why it's fine? Is because literally the sprinklers turn on and it's gone.
Exactly.
It's
rainstorm
not a big
and
deal.
It's there. And for her to compare it to graffiti or defacing property is laughable.
No, it is not the same thing.
It's like, it's not going to decrease your property value. All it takes is a hose.
Literally.
It's so stupid.
Like, if you're that mad about it, go get a hose. Oh,
anyway, so if you want to follow along with the event or just see her cool chalk art, because it's cute. Like, I love watching it.
It's very cute.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because it starts out all rough and then she, like, uses the water and it ends up, like, looking perfect at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So cool. So her name is Kara Vaughn and her username is Vera Khan.
Oh yeah.
So it's V-A-R-A-K-A-U-G-H-N and it's the same on Instagram as well. And if you're in Kansas, you can go to her event.
It's very fun.
Yeah. And if not, like, you can just watch along. And yeah, let's all remember that chalk art is not graffiti or harmful in any way.
It's very cute, actually. Also, yeah, just beautify our world. What's the shame in that? Yes.
Adding a little bit more color to those gray sidewalks.
1,000%. Okay, well, the person that I will be shouting out, they actually tagged us and shared our podcast on their Instagram story. So, Hey, Lucy, thanks. If you're listening to this episode, you're the best. But I also just love their art. It's Lucy. Oh, no. Now I feel the pressure of pronouncing her last name correctly because I know she listens. But it's Lucy Sudabi, I think, studio. I'll spell it Lucy, L-U-C-Y dot S-U-D-D-A-B-Y dot studio. She does handmade jewelry using real handpicked flowers and does commissions too, by the way, which, I mean, my artist name that I release music is Daisy.
So you're getting Daisy jewelry, right?
I think a part of me is gonna have to reach out here soon to get a little Daisy choker.
This is so cool.
Yeah, like I love these forget-me-not hair clips. They're so beautiful.
Oh, and it's handmade in the Cotswolds.
Mm-hmm.
The Cotswolds is like a cute little English cottage town.
Yeah, they're really, really just freaky. Oh my gosh, there literally even is a Daisy velvet choker. Oh, there looks like go. I could literally view it on the website right now.
You could buy it right
I now. Could buy it in this instant. Dang it. Okay, well, it's really beautiful. I'm absolutely obsessed with it.
My favorite thing about the pound and the US dollar being very similar right now is less mental math for me when I'm buying things from other places.
That is very fair. I actually, I'm like, oh wait, does she do international shipping? I'll check. Regardless, everyone should go check it out because they're also beautiful. All the forget-me-not chokers, maybe I'll just get a forget-me-not choker instead because they're so, so
cute.
And the rose, like the petals, the clips.
I do love forget-me-nots.
Me too. So yes, go check her out. And yeah, thanks for listening, Lucy. You're the best.
Yeah, that's so cool. Now I want one.
Me too. All right, now back to the show.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Well, I'm going to touch on some of the ways that the male gaze has been portrayed in media, specifically, I think, with our movies. So basically, if you think of any, I dare say any movies that were directed by men, you'll find that most often they're filmed in ways that benefit the male viewer, like we mentioned. So here's some examples. The first one I'm going to talk about is Transformers, where with Michaela Barnes, who is the character that is played by Megan Fox in the 2016 Transformers film, by the way, directed by Steven Spielberg, where she is a skilled mechanic, a former car thief. And, you know, you would think with that description that that could be a really cool character. But no, the character is not illustrated as intelligent or resilient as a mechanic. There's not really much elaboration on her past at all, even though, like, a car thief, that's intriguing. She's just the love interest and she's just really hot. And that's the focal point of her character, is that she's really hot. And it's almost like the fact that she's a car mechanic just makes her, like, the cool, not like other girls, as opposed to being, like, a legitimately cool thing that someone could be passionate about that would be worth, you know, learning about, making a part of their character. If you
want to see exactly how this character is treated in one scene, you look at the camera work on when she lifts up
the car hood.
The car hood.
Yep.
And it pans up her body, and then you see Shia LaBeouf doing the exact same thing in the scene. And I read a thing that said how that, like, validates the male viewer. Like, it allows them to do it too, because if the character on screen's doing it, then it makes what they're doing okay.
Ew.
Yeah, and I'll bring it up again in another one, because I saw it in another one and I was like, oh my gosh, that's exactly what they're doing. But, like, if you watch what the camera does, it is exactly the male gaze, because it pans up her body, like, focuses on her stomach and her boobs, barely even gets to her head before they switch.
That is really gross. I never thought of it, that it's like, it's almost like giving them permission to view women that way.
Mm. yeah, and saying like, oh, of course you did that. You're human. Look at this poor man on screen. He did the exact same thing as you.
Totally. Another example is Harley Quinn's character in Suicide Squad, played by Margot Robbie. She was very much for the male gaze because she's very sexy. I mean, Margot Robbie's a beautiful, beautiful woman.
She is.
But in the cartoons, her character often wore a clown-inspired costume that barely showed any skin at all, when in Suicide Squad, she was almost naked.
Yeah. I have more on Harley Quinn. We'll talk about her a little bit later.
Okay, too. Cool. Because I know at the most recent Harley Quinn movie that Margot Robbie starred in, there's like such a difference
yes.
in the way that that character is portrayed. Another example is the Wolf of Wall Street.
And Margot Robbie.
Oh my gosh. I know. I'm like, that poor woman.
Yeah. I would say Margot Robbie and Megan Fox, I think, are the two biggest victims in Hollywood of the male gaze, in my opinion.
I think that is fair. And I mean, granted, with Wolf of Wall Street, I actually don't know, because part of me is like, I don't think they're trying to say this is a good way of being.
But they allowed it.
But yeah, I agree.
Like, I think in the article, it talked about how, like, all they had to do to show how marginalized women were on the Wall Street trading floors were a few key scenes featuring prostitutes and parades of strippers. Instead, Scorsese and Winter carry on in shot after shot, displaying True. Dozens of barely clothed or naked female bodies whose not-so-private parts are meticulously waxed or shaven. Mm. The breast stilettos and shimmying bottoms continue ad nauseum, starting to feel like the filmmakers are being seduced by the very Wall Street machismo they purposefully critiqued.
That's true. It's almost like, no, we're critiquing this. It's like,
yeah, it's almost like they saw it as a pass. They're like, oh, well, we're critiquing it, so therefore we can do it as many times as we want.
It's kind of like what they said they were doing with Euphoria, I think. They were like, yeah. No, we're critiquing bad relationships. It's like, well, then I think you can prove your point without me having to see her boobs over and over yeah. and over again.
Well, there's so many different ways and like examples of movies where I think you can depict things without like showing it over and over and over again.
Totally. Oh, 1000%. Yes. Another example is Top Gun and Jurassic World. Top Gun, I would dare say in also the most recent one and the 1986 one, but there is Kelly McGillis. She is first introduced by a scene that shows only her legs when she walks in.
Which is also how Harley Quinn was introduced.
Mm-hmm. In just the beginning a close up to her body.
Well, yes. Especially legs. That seems to be a repeating.
Yes. And then when Claire Deering, or Bryce Dallas Howard, who plays her, runs away from a dangerous T-Rex in Jurassic World. This came out in 2015, so it's not like this is like an old problem. Yeah. There's like the shot that focuses on her running. I guess it's like they're probably like, wow, look at her. She's running in heels. But it's almost like emphasizing like the helplessness and the femininity yeah. of them. But what I love this quote, it said, this takes away the nuance and agency of female characters, making the audience view them as objects instead of people. In such films, the female character's thoughts, feelings, and desires are swept away. The primary focus is what she can provide to fulfill the male desire, both in film and for the audience. In such film, women are seen as love interests for the male lead to win over the end or passive side characters. There is a lack of films that characterize people and women from the woman's eyes. And the last example I'll give is in Avengers. When Natasha Romanoff was played by Scarlett Johansson, when she was first introduced in Iron Man 2, she was nothing more than a femme fatale, basically. Tony Stark says, oh, I want one after meeting her. But then eventually her character was finally explored in the later Avengers movies. But at first we were definitely like spoon-fed a shallow, sexy depiction of her. But like, it's not like that backstory didn't exist for the character.
No,
like she had a very fascinating built-in backstory from the comic books. And then later films, like I said, she did become a full-fledged character, but I read that this kind of happened by accident because the mostly male Marvel writers, they just recognized that audiences were intrigued by her and that they could capitalize on that. Not because like that was their intention from the start.
Yeah.
You know, it was almost like, oh, women are watching this too. And oh, they want to know more about her. Cool. We'll make this for them then.
It also reminds me of like the uproar that Captain Marvel got.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about
that. Like people were so mad about her because they were mm-hmm. calling like her outfit too feminist and the movie too feminist. I went and saw it. It wasn't that.
Yeah, I didn't think it was either. I liked it.
I walked out and heard the criticism, and I was like, did I miss something? Like,
that happens all the time. I feel like people are like, oh, this and this is like, well, I enjoyed it. So,
I thought it was beautiful. Like, I thought it was great. And it was more she was more like a tomboy character, so it made sense for her to be in what she was wearing. Like,
totally.
It didn't make any sense to me why everyone is so mad about it. I was like, she's a military woman. She let her wear her cargo pants and buy a baseball hat. Like,
of course that's what she's gonna wear.
Yeah. It was so weird. But yeah, like, it reminds me kind of that where, you know, Romanoff, you know, she was a sexy character that they allowed to have more substance later.
Totally.
Where sometimes when they try to add a character with substance right off the bat, if she's like not sexy enough, then people get mad.
I do also want to talk about the fact that the male gaze is just as toxic for men as it is for women, because a lot of men see men like Vin Diesel, Chris Hemsworth, and think that that's what they need to be like, because this is what society tells them that women want. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, go to the gym, pump their bodies. They're like alpha bros. But I think this is a good way to transition to the female gaze, because it's like, a lot of the times it's like, no, 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 that's not actually what women want. That's just what other men want from you. You know, we've talked about this a lot where it's like, it seems like the men from our past, they didn't actually like girls. They just wanted to get girls because it would make other men think they were cool. Like, it would make them look good to other men.
Yeah.
So like they
and you know, that's a lot of the reason why men say derogatory things about women's bodies, or like look for a partner who looks exactly how they want them to. It has nothing to do with their own personal preference.
No.
You really love someone, you don't care what weight they are. You don't care whether or not their hair was washed that day. You know what I mean? Like,
totally.
You know, like, obviously.
To an extent. Yeah.
But I think that, like, if you want a partner only to show off how they look to everyone else,
you care more about...
Yeah, then you're caring more about what other people think, i.e. other men, rather than what you actually care about.
1,000%. A very, very huge problem. I more recently have seen Taylor Lautner talking about it, where like he's gotten almost like criticism because he doesn't look as good as he used to. But then he really talked about what he was doing to his body to achieve the level of fitness.
And he was 18.
Yeah. And it's not maintainable. It's not healthy. It's not good. And so the fact that it's like men are seeing that as the ideal, where it's like, no, you like, it's just not good. And it's not something to attain, because like, that's actually going to like cause harm
also,
for your body.
Like, he was 16, I think, when the first Twilight movie came out.
Yeah.
So for the second one, he would have been 17 with how ripped he was.
He was a kid.
Yeah. And then it also makes me think of like how a lot of runway supermodels are like 16-year-old girls.
Totally.
And then we look at that as the idealized body, when it's like,
that's gross.
Guys, that's a child. Like, both of them, children. Mm-hmm. Their metabolisms are moving so fast because they are still growing.
Yeah, because their body's trying to grow.
And just how maybe we need to focus a little bit more on what the mature body looks like and how beautiful that can be.
I love this graphic that you put in where it's like, I think the best imagery I've seen to explain the difference between what men think male objectification is versus what women actually want is to see Hugh Jackman on magazine covers.
Yep.
Where, like, the Muscle and Fitness magazine, it is full Wolverine, so shredded, not
shirtless,
you know, shirtless,
angry
he looks
face.
Mean. And then for Good Housekeeping, he's like in a sweater. He just looks nice and clean. He doesn't look
smiling
as buff. Like, he looks like a fit dude, but like not to the level.
It cracks me up, especially the headlines. Like, you've got Hugh Jackman. What does it say? The recipe that built the star of Logan.
Yeah.
Or, the routine. So it's like Hugh Jackman, the routine that built the star of Logan on the men's magazine. And then on the women's magazine, Hugh Jackman's recipe for romance. What keeps his marriage rock solid?
This is what women want. It's adorable, honestly.
It's so cute. And yet, like, you tell me, like, which one looks more attractive to me? The cute little Hugh Jackman in a sweater.
I want Hugh Jackman in a blue sweater. I don't, like, that's horrifying. I'm good. The other one.
And also how, like, women talk about how much they love Hugh Jackman getting to do all these musical roles because he's just, like, a little theater kid at heart. And we're like,
oh. I love that. Oh, also, this is making me laugh where this, like, caption from, I think, Tumblr. It's like, Hugh Jackman on a women's magazine. He looks like a dad. He looks like he's going to bake me a quiche and sit and watch Game of Thrones with me. He looks like he gives really good hugs. I'm like, so
true. And
then
it said, like, men think women want big, hulking, naked men in loincloths, which is why they always quote He-Man as male objectification, without realizing that He-Man is naked and buff in a loincloth because men want him to be. True. Warm women would be happy to see him in a pink apron cutting vegetables and singing off-key to 70s rock.
That is truly my dream man that was just described there.
It also makes me think of, like, Ken.
Yes.
Uh-huh. You know, like Barbie and Ken, how Ken was always kind of just like Barbie's counterpart to like help her out with whatever she was doing. Mm-hmm. Like, I think, wasn't there a set where like Barbie was the doctor and Ken was the nurse?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It's so funny.
It is. Where it's just like Ken was there to help her because Barbie, you know, wanted a boyfriend.
Yeah.
But like Barbie, she drove the dream car.
Is it her dream house?
Yeah. And he just wore his little Hawaiian shirt and his roller skates.
Which I think is a main plot point of the new Barbie movie coming up. So. Yes,
exactly.
I love it.
So funny.
Well, I think this is a great segue then to talk about the female gaze then.
Yes.
So would you like to define it for us?
Yes. The female gaze is a term, once again, created by a feminist film theorist. Mm-hmm. This time, it was used to counter the male gaze in movies. Is it the same theorist?
Is it Laura Mulvey? Yeah, same one.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so she defined both.
Hooray. Cool.
Yeah. It's the opposite. So my favorite example of this, actually, is going back to Harley Quinn.
Yeah.
You have Harley Quinn for showing up as Margot Robbie in Suicide Squad. Will you actually click on a link for me? I want you to watch this.
The dressing scene one?
Yes.
Cool.
I'll describe it for everyone else. So in the scene, it's when they get off of the helicopters and stuff and they give them back their bins of clothing.
Oh, and yeah.
Allowing them to dress again.
Oh, and she is just like fully naked in her bra and underwear and everyone's stopping to look at her.
And do you see what the camera does with her?
Yeah,
pans slowly up her moves up her body. And then once she pulls her shirt down, she looks around and everyone is staring at her. Entire camp of men. There's no women. They're all looking at her. Mm-hmm. And she goes, "What?" And then they all look away and move on. And once again, validating the viewer to look at her as an object.
Also, let's talk about how her jean shorts are basically just a denim thong.
Yeah. And like ripped clothing,
yeah.
Heels, once again. She's about to go fight crime and they put her in heels.
You know, really practical footwear for fighting crime, absolutely.
Yeah, so I found like this YouTube video as well by, it's like a video essay. I will link that one as well because I cannot find the person's name right now. But she talked a lot about like Birds of Prey versus Suicide Squad and just how the camera angles were shot. Mm-hmm. That shows such a difference in how the two directors and everything viewed the character. And it's worth noting that Birds of Prey was a female director.
Totally.
Also costuming. She said it's interesting if you look at the fact that the costuming wasn't actually like that different. And yet it was so different.
Like, it's still short shorts and a tight shirt. But like the way it looks, it is so different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They made her hair shorter. So someone noted like her pigtails aren't long enough to pull on anymore, which.
Oh.
Yeah. Her bangs are more like choppy and fun rather than like seductively like framing her face instead of like these long pieces. Uh-huh. They made them like fun, choppy bangs.
Yeah.
They are pretty sure they made her wear a padded bra in Suicide Squad.
Your boobs are a little bit smaller in Birds of Prey, which is, I mean, totally fine, but. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm guessing she didn't have a breast reduction between films, so yeah. Mm-hmm. That shows some costuming. And then her skimpy clothing looks more like a choice rather than the tired women's clothes strategically ripped across her rib cage exactly where it needs to be seen. Also, other things, like in Suicide Squad, she's wearing a dog collar.
Yeah, true.
And her shirt literally says Daddy's Little Monster, which I know it ties into the whole Joker thing, but like,
that's
come on.
Yeah. Let's not be so on the nose of what we're doing here.
Yeah, whereas in Birds of Prey, like, she's still wearing short shorts. She's still, like, her shirt is technically more revealing, and yet somehow it looks very much so less revealing.
Also, I'm seeing this point, too, where it's almost like the camera is focusing on her boobs in the Suicide Squad versus on her face in the Birds of Prey.
Put her boobs at the center of the frame in Suicide Squad, whereas her face is.
Yes.
Anyways, I think that's a perfect example. Like, if you want to see the difference between how they view a female.
And it's not just inherently more modest, less modest.
No. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with that. It's like not how they allow the character to be. And what is interesting also is there was a huge uprising about Birds of Prey. A lot of men walked away from that film and said, wow, they took all of the sex appeal away from Harley.
Maybe it wasn't ever supposed to be there in the first place.
Yeah, but also, why on earth would her being an independent person
take away her being sexy?
Yeah. What does that have to do with anything? You know? Like, it's so weird.
Like, let's do some internalized work here and see what that means if, like, someone being, like, I mean, granted, I know, like, the character of Harley Quinn isn't a good person by any means. But,
no,
you know, it's, like, confident, flirty, fun, silly. Like, those are good traits for a woman to have.
Yes.
And why are you so turned off if it doesn't exist for you, those traits?
Exactly. So, very interesting. Also, I really loved the movie Birds of Prey.
I never watched it. I should.
I think it's really fun. I would recommend it, actually.
Fake.
I liked
over
it.
Here.
Need yeah, to watch she it. Like breaks up with Joker right at the beginning.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then it's like kind of the whole story after that. It's fun. I thought it was a fun movie. So another thing to note. So that's like how a woman is depicted in the female gaze. There's also a lot to note about how men are written by a woman or like depicted by women. So men think women want like the knight in shining armor, rescues the damsel in distress. And someone called it the male power fantasy.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So they want to be wealthy, mysterious hero who saves the day and gets the girl. And they compare it to, like, Christian Bale's Batman, which I think is such a good example of the male gaze. Because, like, how many men talk about how that's, like, their favorite superhero movie?
1,000%.
And yes. I don't hear very many women talking about that being their favorite superhero.
No. If anything, I liked the, oh, my gosh, what is his name? The most recent Batman one.
Oh, with Robert Pattinson.
Yeah, I like that one. I don't know if that's a like unpopular opinion, but that's a great
My favorite superhero is Ant-Man.
That is a female gay superhero, I dare say.
Give me Paul Rudd with his ankle monitor playing GarageBand.
Yeah, that's the week. Yeah, valid, honestly.
Who's a dad and like takes care of his little daughter.
Just like wants to take care of his kid. Yeah, that's super fair. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's so female gaze.
That is female gaze coded. Yeah.
And so like that's how a lot of men look at the ideal man, the ideal character of a man. They also compared a lot to like Loki versus Thor. That one gets compared a lot. How a lot of women find Loki a lot more attractive than Thor.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Or you think of like Timothée Chalamet versus Armie Hammer. That seems a little bit more pointed like, with allegations regarding Armie Hammer. So maybe just look at their like physical appearance.
If we're strictly doing vibes, not knowing what we now know.
Otherwise, we would all choose Timothée Chalamet, I hope.
Yeah. Yes. Very, very. Yeah.
Also think of like Harry Styles. I think this is probably controversial. I think his is very strategic in that a lot of his stylist and his campaign, like they know what they're doing and what they're appealing to.
Totally. But honestly, I'm fine. That's refreshing that they care about the women audience.
Exactly. He knows what he's working with. And yeah, so he leans into that a lot of like that feminine gaze.
Totally.
And then it just kind of like talks about the fact that women desire emotional intelligence, someone who's unafraid of expressing themselves. Masculinity is a valid way of expressing yourself. So not saying that that's a problem, but it's just seeing beyond physical characteristics and outdated stereotypes to express gentleness, the ability to be oneself. I saw a thing that said almost like men desire objects, women desire people.
Yeah.
I think that's a little harsh way of putting it.
Yeah, but that is harsh. But in like maybe the worst iterations of it.
Exactly. Some more examples I could think of were like the hand flex in Pride and Prejudice.
Which we've discussed many times on this podcast.
It's such a good scene.
It's so hot. It's the hottest thing I've ever seen.
And how like men don't get it.
And that's what's wrong with them.
Yeah. And I love that like some of these are by men. Like that was a male director who shot that scene.
That man understood what he was doing.
Or the eyelash scene in The Holiday, which I'm having like a hard time remembering exactly, but she gets like an eyelash stuck and he like helps her.
That
very feminine gaze. Another one I thought of on my own is the singing scene in 10 Things I Hate About You with Heath Ledger. He gets up and sings on the bleachers and like is dancing and then trips at the end and falls.
I mean, so many women love that movie. Let's think about that.
Exactly. So it's just kind of stuff like that where you have to realize, like, women don't really desire the shirtless Thor. You know, like, he's hot. There's no denying that. But, like, the things that I even find most attractive about Chris Hemsworth are when he's talking about the fact that, like, Natalie Portman wasn't available for a kissing scene. And so they asked him which model he wanted to use that could double as her. Mm-hmm. And he said, actually, my wife's just around the corner and she's the same height. Can we use her?
Oh, that is nice.
Right? And yeah. So they brought him up in the final kiss. And, like, I think it was, I don't remember what movie it is. I'll have to look it up. The final kiss in one of them where you don't see Natalie Portman's face. That's Chris Hemsworth's wife.
That is cute.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, the thing about I like Chris Hemsworth is he seems charming. He seems nice. He seems like mm-hmm. a good guy. It's not that yeah. he's got muscles. I mean.
No. Like, yeah, he's objectively very attractive.
No, I can objectively use my eyeballs, but, like, that's not the appeal, really.
No. The appeal is,
there's plenty of attractive
people
out there.
Who he comes across as a human being. Mm-hmm. Like, the characteristics he has as a person. And I think that that's kind of, like, the important part of it also. I think also women get a lot of flack for finding a lot of the Marvel men attractive. But I've seen edits, like, done by female Marvel fans. Mm-hmm. And they focus a lot on how they stick up for Scarlett Johansson. Yeah, but also how they stick up for her in interviews when people start asking her about, like, her sex life or her outfits and stuff. And they'll be like, oh, you know, like, I had to do a scene shirtless and jump right in and, like, take over and ease it for her because they're like, she doesn't deserve this.
And, like, they recognize the double standard.
Yeah.
True.
So it's like, it's stuff like that that women cling to with these characters. Not
those people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, not how hot they look half naked.
True. Yeah. Very, very true. Some examples of just movies that were made for women. We've talked about this before where it's like women only account for 2% of producers, 19% of executive producers, 11% of writers, 11% of directors, 4% of cinematographers. And then last year, 24% of protagonists in that 100 highest grossing films were women. So, like, you know, the representation. But some movies that I think are obviously for women. I haven't seen this movie, but Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Also, Lady Bird is definitely for women. One example I loved, I actually haven't seen Killing Eve, but now after reading about this, it makes me want to. Because it's a rare show that depicts, like, dangerous women with obviously, like, bad motives. So it's not all about portraying women as, like, perfect, all, you know, all virtuous beings. But the character that was played by Sandra Oh and Jodie Corner's assassin, they're not defined by their female sexuality. Instead, they are inhibited by it as they explore their femininity through everything. And it's basically, like, the fact that it's, like, it could have been a femme fatale. Like, if a man wrote this, it would have been, like, the sexy, you know, like, that's what it is. But it's not about that at all. It's them showing them as, like, real human beings as opposed to them being sexy. So I thought that was, like, a cool, like, counter to what that femme fatale is. Another example is Fleabag. I also haven't seen that.
No, I'm like, I need to watch some of these.
I know. But then the last one is Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Have you seen Crazy Ex-Girlfriend?
I don't think so. Maybe I have.
The show, oh my gosh. That show is actually probably one of my favorites of all time. In the ways that it's like, I don't think I ever want to watch it again because some of the scenes made me very, very uncomfortable. Just because, like, well, the protagonist is not a person that you always love. You love her, but she's very flawed. And so sometimes it's just, like, hard to watch as she, like, messes her life up. It was written by a woman and it's so funny. It's like my exact humor, which, like, take that what as you will. Maybe that's a good thing to you. Maybe that's a bad thing to you. But I love Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So I guess there's some recommendations of some very popular TV shows that you can go support that are made maybe with a woman-minded audience, with the female gaze in mind.
Yes.
If you want to go watch something for you.
Love that.
Well, dang. Anything else we need to touch on?
I don't think so. I think it just comes back to, like, being really aware of what you're watching.
Totally.
And consuming.
And how we talked about earlier, it's like sometimes preferences are society compounding on itself. I don't know.
Yeah, it really does. It makes you think really differently about, like, I don't know, because I was even thinking, I was like, wow, is it bad that, like, objectively I think Chris Hemsworth is hotter than, like, Loki?
Tom Hiddleston?
Yeah.
Well, okay, here's the thing. I guess there's a balance, because, like, sure, some preferences are just people's preferences, and that's legitimate. That's so legitimate. But sometimes they could come from other things. And
I know.
So, or, like, also, I think even more dangerously is the expectations we put on ourselves. That's where it becomes, I think, dangerous, is if you see all these beautiful, hot women. Sometimes it's hard for me, you know, to like see hot women all over media and be like, well, I am not so naturally sexy and hot, you know, and they're also not either. They got camera angles and film crews that are panning up their bodies, and it's probably photoshopped. It's not fair to us. It's not fair to them. And you don't have to be so hard on yourself. And same with men. Men don't have to be so hard on themselves.
No, definitely not. I think, yeah, it's important to realize how much it benefits both of us to not give in to the stereotypes at all. We're like, okay, let's all just be nicer and realize that all of these are extremely idealized versions, and none of it's realistic for either side.
Yeah, like, no, both parties are being negatively affected here.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us today, listener, and be back next week because we'll be discussing another artist. And I picked mine out especially for Pride Month. She has a crazy cool story. So come back, learn about her. And if you're a big fan of the podcast and have been liking it, leave us a rating review. Follow us on Instagram, morethanamuse.podcast. And I would love to know what kind of episodes and what kind of content you like as we're planning out the rest of the year. Send us some ideas. We can definitely see if we can filter that into what we're doing.
Yeah, definitely. We're always open for things, especially because we don't hear about everything that all of you do.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Out there in the art and media world. We'll see you next week.
Yay. See you next week.